Hello and welcome to our program. My name is Rick Miles and I will be reading the news of Houston here on Sight into Sound Radio. Let's start out with an article from Innovation Map out of Houston, written by John Egan. And here he talks about the advantage that Houston's going to get because we are poised to win benefits from the presidential primary debate coming up this coming week. If past presidential debates are any accurate barometer, Houston stands to reap billions of dollars worth of benefits from what's being called Super Bowl of politics. However, one economist isn't casting his vote for any sizable economic surge from the upcoming presidential debate in Houston. On September 12, Houston's Texas Southern University, one of the largest historically black universities in the country, will host the third debate of the Democratic presidential primary season. The Democratic National Committee and ABC TV picked the 150-acre TSU campus for this showdown, where 10 Democratic candidates are set to take the stage in the 8,100-seat H&PE Arena. While the Greater Houston Partnership is not able to provide an estimated economic impact of the Houston debate, it still sees the value of Houston basking in the national spotlight. According to Bob Harvey, who is president and CEO of the Greater Houston Partnership, Texas Southern University hosting the third Democratic presidential primary debate here in Houston will focus national attention on the city for several days in much the same way that Republican presidential debate did back in 2016. These events put Houston on top of mind among people across the country, including the companies and talented individuals that we are working to recruit to the city of Houston. Well, the debate will help showcase Houston as a diverse city that's tackling presidential-level issues like education, infrastructure, and climate change. Harvey says that climate change, and in particular, hits close to home in Houston as the city is redefining its role as the energy capital of the world through local initiatives taking on renewables and carbon emissions as well as sustainability, according to Harvey. 3 years ago, the University of Houston hosted a Republican presidential debate featuring five candidates. For historical context, Houston hosted the Democratic National Convention in 1928 and then the Republican National Convention in 1992. Brandon Rottengrass, a professor of political science at UH, who's an expert on the presidency, says nationally televised debates serve as a massive platform for host colleges and universities to recruit faculty and students beyond their normal regional or local confines. Furthermore, he says presidential debates can elevate the status of these schools in the realm of public discourse. Rottenhouse said that these debates are also a way to connect to alumni networks far-flung around the nation and give them something to brag about that's really not sports-related. No estimates were provided of the economic impact for the University of Houston debate, but other spots in the U.S., communities, and college campuses have hosted presidential debates that tout millions of dollars in value from debate-related spending and free publicity. In October 2012, the Boca Raton, Florida area realized an immediate economic impact of $13.1 million from hosting the final debate ahead of that year's presidential election, as well as $63.7 million in free publicity from the news coverage of the nationally televised event. Those figures come from a study commissioned by Lynn University, which hosted the debate. An accompanying survey found that after watching the debate, 4.7 million American adults definitely wanted to visit the Boca Raton area over the next 5 years. Also back in 2012, the University of Denver hosted a general election debate that generated an estimated $56 million in free publicity. Victor Matheson, an economist at the College of Holy Cross in Worcester, Massachusetts, dismisses those figures as inflated and irrelevant. And he says Houston should not expect the city or TSU to receive any direct economic benefits from the September 12th debate. For one thing, Matheson downplays the value assigned to free publicity surrounding a presidential debate. He complains that the methodology applied to tallying the benefits of the so-called earned media coverage is flawed. For another thing, Matheson notes that few people from outside the Houston area will be attending the debates at TSU, meaning little in the way of revenue from hotel stays, meals, and other visitor expenditures. He said this is not a Super Bowl. As a matter of fact, Houston hosted the 50th Super Bowl. That was in February of 2017, and they fielded an economic impact of $347 million, thanks to spending by some 150,000 visitors. That is according to a study commissioned by the Super Bowl Host Committee of Houston. While not on the scale of the Super Bowl, of course, the upcoming debate will attract positive attention for TSU, Matheson points out. He said this sort of debate can really put a college on the map, especially one like Texas Southern, a fairly obscure university from a national standpoint, he told Innovation Map. Matheson cites St. Almsham College in Manchester, New Hampshire, for example. A few people outside New England would ever have heard of St. Almsham without its frequent hosting of presidential debates since the 1980s. The college has been dubbed the academics epicenter of the first in the nation New Hampshire primary. During the 2015-16 political season alone, St. Anselm hosted one Republican and one Democratic presidential debate, leading to more than 8,000 mentions in the news media of the college or its New Hampshire Institute of Politics. According to Matheson, so the effect of the college is real, but there is still a question about how big it is. And let's not pretend that the debate is somehow going to put Houston on the map. If Houston isn't on the map already, you really need to get yourself a new map. Well, let's see. I know some stuff that puts us on the map, not necessarily always good. This one from Florian Martin of KUHF. He said, new report shows that air pollution from plastics plants in greater Houston is getting worse. Nearly two-thirds of the plastics-producing plants in the Houston area have violated air pollution limits over the past 5 years. That's according to an analysis of public records from the Austin and Washington-based Environmental Integrity Project. The report looked at plants that manufacture plastics, or the ingredients of plastics, and found that pollution is expected to get worse as many plants are expanding. According to EIP Communications Director Tim Pelton, he said, we found 45 expansions and new plants being proposed, and we don't know how much air pollution will come from these new projects. But we do have a permit applications for a third of them, and if you look at the third for which we have information on 16 of these expansion projects, they would be permitted to emit an additional 14,000 tons of pollution annually. In 2017, plastics plants in the region emitted 55,704 tons of pollutants. That's according to the report. It also found that 19 of the existing 90 plastic-related plants have been cited for not meeting emergency plan requirements. The Environmental Integrity Project is calling on the state to step up oversight of the industry. Pelton said, the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality needs to keep a close eye on them because they are not following the Clean Air Act and they're often not following safety planning laws, which can be dangerous for the surrounding community. That's end of quote. A spokesperson for the TCEQ declined to comment, saying the agency had a chance to read the report and evaluate its methodologies. The American Chemistry Council issued the following written statement in response, quote, American Chemical Council, ACC members, have reduced hazardous releases to the air, land, and water by 84% from 1989 to 2016, and reduced the number of safety incidents by 60% since 1995. ACC members are committed to going beyond regulatory requirements to manage, monitor, and report progress through responsible care, our health, safety, economic, and security performance program. It includes systems to continuously improve performance, third-party certification of practices and systems, and transparent reporting of results, end quote, of the response, written statement from the American Chemistry Council. Something's in the air, huh? From Josette Santana, a writer for Houston's Culture Map, she said, this Houston startup saves homes with self-deploying flood damage prevention. Tasha Nielsen was on a trip to Denmark when she came across a Danish company making strides in flood prevention techniques. She said, we were visiting family one day when we turn on the news and see Flood Frame, that's F-L-O-O-D, capital F-R-A-M-E, Flood Frame's brand launch. The inventors live in Denmark, and they've done installations in Denmark, Germany, and England. and they've been very successful, end quote. That company partnered with the Danish Technology Institute and the Danish Hydraulic Institute and worked for years perfecting their flood prevention system. After Nielsen asked whether she could contract FloodFrame to install their system at her home in Houston, she learned the founders weren't interested in coming over themselves to expand their business to the United States. So, Nielsen took the reins to create the U.S. iteration of FloodFrame. The company provides flood protection to any building, including your home or business. And while it definitely takes inspiration from its European counterpart, Nielsen uses her degree in civil engineering from Texas A&M, specifically her specialty in hydraulics, hydrology, and storm design, to launch the business in one of the most flood-ravaged cities in the United States, Houston. FloodFrame works by using buoyancy. A lightweight cloth is wrapped around a tube, and it's installed underground outside the perimeter of your home or business. One end of that cloth is attached to a box that is also installed underground. As flooding begins, an automatic system will release the lids to deploy the inflation of the tube that will protect the structure. When the flood comes in, the system will float on top of the flood, kind of like a pool noodle, and protect the structure from the water. FloodFrame adds a level of security during flooding events, and it can be considered more cost-effective when compared to the high cost of renovating or rebuilding after flooding. She said, right now we're focused on residential, but I think there's a huge potential for it to go commercial. A lot of commercial buildings are self-insured, and commercial developers, industrial developers, this would be a drop in the bucket for the overall cost of the entire project. She went on to say, for homeowners, it's kind of a bigger expense, but I think there's a potential for home builders to include it as an option in the entire package of a new house, because when you put it into the mortgage, it costs about another 50 cents per month. Well, they're working on it, huh? Here we go. Rain, go away, it says. This comes to us from Community Impact, written by Emma Whalen. Faced with ride-sharing competition, Houston changes approach to taxicab regulations. As competition from ride-hailing services like Uber and Lyft grows, the Houston Department of Administration and Regulatory Affairs has determined Houston can no longer regulate taxicabs in a way that brings in significant revenue to the city. Changes to Houston's taxicab regulations, approved by City Council on September 4, will keep safety requirements in place, but allow the city to divest from the industry. According to at-large council member Max Knox, who said, we're going to be out of the taxicab support business. Essentially, this is an opportunity to give some time to the taxicab companies to adjust their model so they can compete more effectively. Council members approved loosening regulations and lowering prices for taxi permits, as well as a plan to sell off all remaining city-owned permits in a three-lottery-style sale over the next 18 months. By December of 2020, when the final permits are sold, the city will no longer be tasked with determining which providers to sell permits to or the optimal number of permits to sell. ARA Director Tina Pace said that the city will be able to revoke permits should a tax operator violate safety standards. By selling off permits at reduced fees, Houston's new safety-oriented approach to regulation may help keep the industry afloat. That's according to District G Council member Greg Travis. He said, I hope that these people in the taxicab industry understand that the industry is dying by the ride-hailing services, and it needs to innovate. In other words, it doesn't have to come to pass. You're allowing them to do this by letting them set their own rates lower than they used to be able to set. In 2018, 897 taxicab operators in Houston failed to pay permit fees, leaving $983,000 in uncollected debt by the city. That's according to the Houston ARA. Changes to the ordinance regulating taxicabs include reductions in permit fees from $583 per vehicle to $450 and down to $100 for wheelchair-accessible and electric vehicles. Other costly requirements, such as data reporting and expensive card reader technology, are no longer included in the city's ordinance. Wheelchair-accessible taxis will still need to report ride data to the city, and all vehicles must provide card readers, but they will no longer have to provide the specific, costly readers that the city used to require. Several council members said keeping the taxi industry alive is still in the city's best interest. The state of Texas controls ride-hailing service regulations, so taxi cab regulations are the only vehicle for higher regulations that Houston can create. That's according to Mayor Sylvester Turner. Some council members expressed reservations about the effectiveness of these changes. According to District E Council Member David Martin, who said, "I believe this is going to oversaturate the market and kill the taxicab industry. Uber is going to do exactly what they want to do to kill off the taxicab industries in many cities across the United States. They're going to jack up prices and look at their revenue stream. They are losing money every single year. There's a reason for that. And they're trying to kill the industry by taking down their prices and oversaturating the market. And we're playing right into their attempt." Some Houston City Council members also want to keep the taxicab industry alive so they can impose specific safety regulations and ensure that wheelchair-accessible cars remain available. Ride-hailing services do not have vehicle accessibility requirements. Instead, should a driver without an accessible car get asked to pick up a person in a wheelchair, that driver is required, by law, to call an accessible service such as Metro Lyft or a taxi cab company with accessible vehicles in its fleet. The city's taxi cab regulations include the same accessibility requirements as well as further reduced fees for wheelchair accessible vehicles aimed at incentivizing their use. Council members Brenda Schartag and Robert Gallegos expressed concern that if taxi cab companies known to supply accessible vehicles fail because the city's new approach to deregulation does not do enough to boost the industry, there will be even fewer options for people in wheelchairs. Gallegos said, quote, "If one of those companies goes out of business and now you rely on just one contract, there's going to be a gap in coverage out there. If we don't have the service, it's not going to help anyone." Well, as a compromise, the city ordinance was amended to include a provision stating that the ARA department must provide a progress report within 1 month of the beginning of each permit sale period over the next 18 months. If the market for taxi cabs continues to look dire, the city will change its approach too, according to Mayor Sylvester Turner. You're listening to the News of Houston on Sight Into Sound Radio. You can listen to Sight Into Sound on one of our specially tuned radios, Channel 8.5 on TV, Channel HD4 on KQHF 88.7, streaming on your computer or smartphone, as well as Amazon Alexa and Google Home devices. You can also listen at your convenience on our archives page at sightintosound.org. We are Sight Into Sound Radio since 1967. From one of the Buzz magazines, they publish stuff from Bel Air, Memorial, River Oaks, Tanglewood, and West U. This one is from Karen Vine Fuller's. Kind of a cute article about the Section 120 fan club. The road to the Section 120 fan club was long and loyal. Suzanne Feather and Leo Vasquez, proud Houstonians who bleed orange and blue, have been dedicated to the Astros season, dedicated Astros season ticket holders since the Astrodome days. Suzanne grew up on baseball fields with her older brothers in Lubbock. She says, "I just love baseball, and when I'm at a game, it feels like I'm home." In 1999, they joined their fellow Astros faithful in lovingly waving goodbye to three decades of AstroTurf, dome foam, and the scoreboard snorting bulls and cowboys to choo-choo downtown to the bright and shiny train station turned ballpark, Enron Field. Leo and Suzanne's new seats weren't nosebleed, but they also weren't so close to the action that they wanted. The next decade and a half, the Astros had their ups and downs and wins and losses, as well as team colors and uniform choices. Even the name of the ballpark changed in 2002 when Enron debacle led to the field being renamed Minute Maid Park. When other ticket holders decided to throw in their bats, Suzanne and Leo remained true and kept putting on their rally caps. Suzanne said, "Sometimes I was the only one sitting in our section. Many times I sent out emails, text messages, and posts on Facebook for anyone to use our four tickets. Not a single person responded." Well, the good news was that better seats became available, so Suzanne and Leo were able to upgrade. In 2014, the dedicated couple finally got the right-behind-home plate seats of which they had always dreamed, Section 120. They have been celebrating and bonding with their fellow season ticket holders ever since. Thankfully, the Astros' luck started to turn around about that time, too. Suzanne said, we love the Astros either way, but I got to tell you, it's a lot more fun when they're winning. And just bury me in Astros orange. Soon after they moved to their new seats, Leo started a tradition of snapping a selfie of Suzanne and their two guests and himself in their seats and posting it on Facebook. As they bonded with their Section 120 neighbors, more people would gather up for a group photo. Their Facebook friends never knew who might pop in Suzanne and Leo's Astro game photos. After a few years, Leo decided to organize all of the photos into an online album. He said, it was fun to see all of our friends, family, and guests that had used the seats over the years. I tried to decide what to name the album, and that's how the Section 120 Fan Club was born. Different configurations of the Hale family sit in the four seats right behind Suzanne and Leo. Enthusiastic high-fives are shared with the Hales and friends whenever the Astros score. The Hales' youngest daughter, Kate, a seventh grader at Annunciation Orthodox School, is an avid fan. Even her bedroom is decked out in orange and blue. And she's often in the seats with a friend and her mom, Tracy. Like a proud aunt and uncle, Suzanne and Leo glow. We've enjoyed watching Kate grow up, and she really knows a lot about baseball. Kate is a West University Softball Association pitcher. The Section 120 seats are similar to the umpire's point of view for the plate, so Kate likes to call pitches. And rumor has it, she's pretty accurate. Kate says, sitting in our section is really fun because we all know each other. Even my friends like being in the group picture. I like when my Altuve, Springer, or Bregman big heads face-shaped signs show up in the photo. Newlyweds Shaheen and Brooke Navas, a piece of Minute Maid Park real estate, is one row behind the Hales. Shaheen says, we love how we've bonded during the last 5 years. We've had opportunities to move closer to the field, but we don't want to leave our Section 120 family. It's hard to attend 80-plus home games during a season, so there's often assorted family, friends, and coworkers, as well as clients and friends of friends filling those seats. Shaheen said that it's entertaining when Suzanne, who's never met a stranger, huddles everyone, including confused guests and people that don't know us, sitting in one of the 12 seats together for that group photo. The Nagavis admire Leo's consistent taking of the section selfie. Shaheen says, Brooke and I ask them to please wait until we're in our seats so we don't miss taking the picture. We like checking Facebook after each game to see the group, or if we were to the game, we can see who ended up sitting in our seats. One frequent Section 120 Fan Club regular is Jason Fuller. He said, at first, I'd see photos from the Astros games on Suzanne and Leo's Facebook posts, and then I started noticing there was a picture of them and their guests sitting with them at every game. He said, you wonder jokingly, how come I'm not there with them in those pictures and those awesome seats? It's become a regular thing to check the album to see who Leo and Suzanne are taking. They have so many friends, it's fun to see who's there with them. You might might be able to know some of them as well. Sort of like a 6 degrees of separation from Leo and Suzanne. Their niece, Alex Fowler, says that loving baseball is in our family's DNA. And Suzanne is seriously one of the biggest fans you'll ever meet. She even dyed her hair orange for the World Series. It took her 3 days because she had to bleach her hair out and then re-dye it orange. Suzanne and Leo's daughter Jennifer Feather is also a true orange and blue fan. Jennifer lives in North Carolina, Suzanne says, but she's such a devoted Astros fan that she plans her October work schedule around the playoffs. The last 3 years, she's made sure she can be off and available to go to games just in case the Astros need her. Twyla Carter is executive director of the Astros Foundation, but she said that title is only surpassed by being a Section 120 fan club member. Twyla says, it's neat how Section 120 has become a community of fans that have gotten to know each other. They have some great seats, and they're having a great time supporting the team. Twyla tries to stop by and say hello every game. I know they're always posting their pictures on Facebook. Sometimes I try to photobomb them because I'm always working, and they're always having a good time. Another VIP appeared to Section 120 Fan Club is Barbara Hauser, one of the original Astros spacettes. Were female ushers in the out-of-this-world uniforms when the Astro Dome opened back in 1965. The biggest VIP photobomber has been Astros president Reed Ryan so far. Suzanne says fans of other teams sit in their seats sometimes too. So we appreciate all fans supporting their team, but it's a rule you cannot dislike the Astros. In fact, our daughter's partner, Andra Apt, is an equally devoted Cleveland Indians fan. They were here for the Indians-Astros playoff game last year. We allow each to appreciate their team. It's baseball. Be gracious. It's a civil sport. Section 120 Fan Club. It says no matter where you watch those Astros, Minute Maid Park or home, or with whom you watch it, Section 120 seatmates or your cat, or whatever you wear, an Astro jersey or a pajamas, Astros fans are saying, we're going to take it back. Let's hope so this year. There's some renovations going on as renovations move into next phase. And this is at Metro Northwest Transit Center. It comes to us from Impact Magazine's Sean Arage. Work on renovation in the Northwest Transit Center in Houston took a step forward back on September 3rd as crews began construction on the site's main bus platform. The center, located at the intersection of the 610 West Loop and Highway 290, just in the northwest corner, has been undergoing renovations since June and that have resulted in several lane and ramp closures. The project entails building a new ramp on the site, a new bus platform, and more parking spaces, according to the Metropolitan Transit Authority of Harris County, which operates the facility and is overseeing those renovations. Once completed, the total number of bus bays at the center will increase from 12 to 20, and the number of parking spaces will increase from 120 to 256, that's according to Metro. Bus service will still be offered while work on the platform is underway, officials said. Riders will use a temporary platform on the site, and a series of new bus stops have been added along Old Katy Road. Pedestrian crossings have also been established at the site, and a police officer has been assigned the area from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. to help pedestrians cross Old Katy Road, according to the release. The Northwest Transit Center serves as a park and ride, and while also providing sheltered waiting areas where several bus routes converge. Once renovations are completed, the center will also connect to the new Uptown Bus Rapid Transit route that's being established by Metro. The $17.9 million project is part of Metro's 2019 Capital Improvements Program. In a previous interview with Community Impact Newspapers, Metro's spokesperson Jack Gill said that construction will be done in phases, and that should go all the way through the end of 2020. We've come to the end of our program. I've been reading the News of Houston. You can hear the News of Houston Sunday morning at 8:30 and Monday night at 10. I'm Rick Miles, and this has been a production of Sight into Sound Radio, Houston, Texas.